And I'm like, oh. So I put them on my face and I just go and panic and just punch the goggles into my face so they seal. And then I swim again for another 2 hours.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to this next episode of Beyond Victory. Ross Edgley today is with us, and we've just been chatting before coming on just now, and I can tell you this is going to be awesome, so I'm going to take the risk of saying this is going to be awesome 100%. You agree?
I agree. We said it now, haven't we? We've got to deliver.
Exactly, but we will. We're used to that, no?
Yes.
We're used to delivering under pressure.
That is it.
If there's one thing we can do, I think there's that.
Yes.
And we're sitting here now in London, actually, in the, 12th floor, huge windows looking out onto some massive square, beautiful day. So, so let's jump right into it. Do you want to intro your podcast
as
well?
That's right, yeah, Nick. Like you just said, actually, I mean, I'm so excited about this just because I think we come from such different worlds in that exactly what you've done, you know, in Formula One and myself, you know, for those who probably don't know, last year, became the first person to swim all the way around mainland Great Britain. And I know when we were talking on email, what I find fascinating and what I hope to sort of like reverse engineer and deconstruct today is this idea that for me and the Great British Swim, it was 157 days of swimming for 12 hours a day. So it was this idea of complete sort of sensory deprivation. You know, I was there looking at the bottom of the seabed for 12 hours a day, whereas with you, it's the complete opposite. And it's almost like sensory overload, you know, that you, when driving, have to make decisions, not only decisions, you know, life and death decisions, you know, with split seconds, you know, to actually process it. Whereas I suppose the kind of, for me, the outcome was either I stop, you know, and they take me to land and against my will, probably, you know, me kicking and screaming, or I continue and I reach Margate. So that's one thing, like I said, that I really want to, you know, deconstruct, you know, today as we chat. And I know we've already spoke about an hour off air as well.
So I think I can put my plan in the bin as well. This is going to be totally, totally freestyle. No, but let's attempt to go a little bit on plan. Anyway, I just wanted to cover, you were on Joe Rogan, yeah, which is the greatest podcaster in the world at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And can you say something about him? Like,
oh, that was amazing. I think what Joe Rogan, and certainly what you're doing as well now, we're seeing, because of social media and where it is now today, we're at such an exciting phase. So with the World's Fittest book, you know, my book last year, I talk about how certainly within sports, there are many ways to get fitter, stronger, leaner, quicker. Don't discriminate against any or favor one. As soon as you do, you close your mind and limit your potential. And what I mean by that is now with social media, we're at this amazing sort of stage of human evolution where we're sharing ideas and physiologies and ideologies and everything. And it's kind of like what you learned from Formula One, I learned from swimming. And Joe Rogan does amazingly how it's just this melting pot of ideas. So for me, that was one of the best things, applying what I learned during the swim. But obviously, he's a foremost leading expert in MMA, and how we could kind of, you know, exchange teachings and learnings, and that's all it is. Again, to slightly go off on a tangent, but during the swim, I read a lot of Stoic philosophy, so Marcus Aurelius, Roman emperor, and
during the swim,
so I would sort of swim for 12 hours and then read a bit of Stoic philosophy on the boat. It was and it was interesting that
I did that during my Formula One race weekends.
Did you actually?
Yeah.
So this is amazing. I'm going to delve straight into my questions because I've got loads. So with Marcus Aurelius, he wasn't trying to write a best-selling book. Meditations, his book. He wasn't trying to write a best-selling book, a Sunday Times bestseller. It was just his diary. And I think a lot of the great Stoics, the ancient Greeks, you know, from Plato, certainly, you know, a celebrated wrestler, but also influenced Western philosophy, that they understood that mind-body connection. And I think one thing that I took from the whole swim is this concept of Stoic sports science. And that's basically, under adverse conditions, you're able to still apply tried and tested scientific principles. And what I mean by that is, something I learned from the Royal Marines, that under complete stress, you have the cognitive clarity of like a five-year-old. You know, you can't process information. You know, you're not thinking straight. Certainly for me when
I've experienced that.
Right. And this is it. So for me, I'm hypothermic on my swim. My tongue's falling apart from salt water exposure. I've got chafing on my neck. I've got sea ulcers that get in an inch deep. But I've still got to apply the same scientific principles and cognitive clarity. But for you, looking at dehydration, the effect of just G-force on the body, you know, overload of the senses. How did you continue to think so clearly, cognitive clarity? Because for you, like I said, the consequences were life and death. So what did you do? What was it? Breathing techniques? Was it like tried and tested? I mean, going back to the Williams aptitude test, how did you do it? What coping strategies?
So the best example is probably then in the last couple of laps on the way to the World Championship. It was almost like red mist. Yeah, because I was fatigued, I was dehydrated, and you have the helmet, so it's really, really hot because there's no air coming in. So it's really, all the clarity is gone. Completely. And then adrenaline all the way into the rev limiter. Yeah. And fear of losing in the rev limiter. Complete Molotov cocktail in the head. So all the clarity is gone. So what the only thing that I could do was in preparation. That's where the huge effort for me went into, to then try and help me in those moments in a natural way. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so preparation was just really simplifying life, focus just on the task at hand. So it was just family and racing. There was no, I deleted social media, no news, no nothing. Yeah. So it's complete dedication to simplicity.
I like
a lot of meditation, like even up to an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening, and just calming the whole life situation down.
Yeah.
And that will then help you have a couple more percent capacity and clarity in those most extreme moments. Yeah.
Right.
I think eventually, even in a race car where you have like long straights, you could have learned to apply some meditation even in those moments, which could have been quite powerful.
Mid-race?
Because you have, wow, on the straights, you have a couple of moments where you can relax. And meditation can be in the form of a flick of a finger. Meditation can be 2 seconds. It can be all throughout your day. It can be little moments all the time. That's really the ultimate form of meditation, actually. It's always bringing yourself back to being present.
Mm.
Very difficult.
Yes.
And I think you can learn to do that in a race car as well. I never managed. and so therefore, I was not able to use that then in towards those last races. But I think that would have been quite powerful.
Is that something you've experimented with now? I've got images of you on a straight in this like meditating with your legs crossed, almost in this like monk-like state. is it? But I love what you said there, because a lot of people think that meditation is this thing that you have to light candles and then you're on a mountain.
Perfect.
And then it's like, no, it's, so what you're saying is it's trying to tap into that mental state. I love what you said there, the click of a fingers.
Yeah, let's cover meditation then. Everybody thinks you need to meditate, you need to go in Google Land and switch off your thinking and go into Nirvana. And if you're not doing that, then you're not meditating well, yeah? And that's complete rubbish.
Yeah.
Meditating is just taking time for self-reflection, sitting down and being present to your thoughts. You can't switch them off, you'll never be able to. But you can be present to your thoughts. And if you learn to be present to them, you can start to have a little bit of control over them and bring yourself back every time to presence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When every time a thought comes, which is running you away with fear or whatever you're doing tomorrow or any worries that you have or sufferings or whatever, you can realize that they're coming again. And you say, oh, okay, now I want to bring myself back to being present, and that's meditation.
Yeah.
And then with time you'll realize that, oh, there's less and less thoughts coming, the whole situation is calmer when I'm meditating, and that will give a really, really positive benefit to your life in general, all these moments of calmness.
And going back to what I love what you said then about almost streamlining stress. So when you said it was family and racing, and did it get to the point where anything else, so if people were sort of sponsors were saying, you know, oh, come and attend this event, or, you know, there's a boat party, you would go, no, you know, it's just racing and family. Is that how you coped with it? Is that almost aiding meditation, where you would just say no? Because that's something with the swim that I was just purely thinking, will it help me swim back to Margate, circumnavigate Great Britain? If the answer is no, I didn't entertain it. And it sounds really bad, actually. It was almost, I mean, I talked about this in my tour, actually, with Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
My God, you've done your studying, huh?
Right.
Now we're going into Maslow now. I've never heard of that guy. But anyway.
So yeah, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. For those listening who don't know, Maslow, a famous psychologist, and he said that if you imagine a pyramid, and at the very base of this pyramid, he said that all humans have these needs that is just food, water, and warmth. As you move up, it's maybe family, friends, security, safety. As you go up, it's more like self-worth, job security. And as you go up, it's kind of self-actualization. So it's, you know, but at the base of this pyramid is just warmth and almost homeostasis, so that habitual level. You need your body to be in a nice state. And I think with certainly during the swim, there was times when, you know, my tongue was falling apart. So, you know, salt tongue, they called it, where through 12 hours of salt water exposure, I was pulling off parts of my tongue. Nah. You know, no, I'm sorry. And then there was even...
Is it all good now? It's back in one piece.
Yeah, it's back to normal. It's back to normal now. And then even so, like, yeah, with chafing and stuff. So like they were about an inch deep, those sea ulcers on my neck. And so a lot of the media were saying, Ross, you know, what do you think about when you're swimming? Do you think about your family, your friends? And I was like, no. You know, if my girlfriend's listening, I'm sorry. But that was like, it was so far up Maslow's hierarchy of needs. That's family and friends. I was at the bottom of that pyramid. So I'm just like food, warmth, and safety. And I suppose my question is it the same that when you were racing, you're just thinking, wow, I need, you know, like you were talking about even deprivation of oxygen, you know, you like, I love what you said, like that cocktail in your head, your biochemistry is all over the place. So would you think about your family when you were actually racing? Or do you just think, I am just trying to cross the finish line safely? Because that's fight or flight, isn't it? Is that right?
Come on, here's the opportunity. It's the love of your girlfriend that kept you going yeah. in the most adverse moment.
You're my wingman. Come on.
That's right. Deliver that's it now. It's the opportunity.
You are my wingman. That's exactly what... But it is. I'm too honest for my own good. But it's I. But
what's her name? What's her name?
Hester.
Hester. Okay, there we go. Hello, Hester. If you're listening to this,
you're such a legend. But would you think about, honestly? Would you think about your wife and kids when you were racing? Honestly.
To what you were saying, yes, it was the most extreme form of simplifying and only doing what will help me to win and be the champion in the end of the year.
Yeah, yes.
But to the most extreme way, yeah? It's total dedication.
So when you're in there, you're thinking, right, turn, left turn, right, okay, and then, foot down.
Well, in the car, unfortunately, my mind, I wasn't the most skillful at being present than in the car. A lot of fear coming in and thinking about, oh, what if that goes wrong? And I'm sure then I would be also thinking about, like, disappointing my family because of all the effort they put in as well. So when driving, that would be...
Oh, so you would think about
it. Yeah, it would be. Wow. And I think that was a weakness of mine. Yeah. I'm sure that other drivers are able to be much more in the moment and have less of these fears and worries and thoughts coming in.
Because that's interesting that when I deal a little bit with the Royal Marines down at Limestone, and some of their psychologists talk about this idea... They said, you need to be more like a ninja. And I was like, okay, this sounds good. I'm listening. And they said, a ninja would have made peace with the fact that in a fight, they're going to die. That's the worst case scenario. And they've made peace with that. They're like, I'm fine with that. You know, that's an honorable death. That's fine. So they were more focused on the process. The outcome was irrelevant. They were just like, if we're fighting, I'm just going to swing my sword better than you. Whereas if they were fighting somebody who was this fear of failure, that they'd already think of the outcome. So that can, you know, upset the process. And it's this kind of fear of failure that can interfere with motor skills and cognitive clarity that we're talking about. So when I was swimming, I was very much just thinking the outcome, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to focus on the process, one arm in front of the other, as efficiently as possible. But what I find fascinating, what you just said, is... Look, the very idea that in 2016, we spoke about this, it blows my mind that if aliens came to this world and they said, what is that? And you'd go, oh, that's a car. They're like, okay, what is it? It's a motorized vehicle. And they'll go, right, okay, understood. Who's the best at that in the world? And in 2016, we would have gone, him. Do you know
him? Still now. Hey, still now. Right. Come on. What are you talking about?
You're right. You know, that blows my mind. But what you've just described actually goes against what a lot of sports psychology says, in that you were saying, yeah, I wouldn't want to let my family down. And you were even processing that, yet you were still the best in the world. That's amazing. So do you think almost your will to win overrided that fear of failure, is what I'm saying? Because you, the sports psychologist would have said, no, Nico, you need to focus on the process. And you're going, well, no, I'm also thinking about my wife and, you know, I don't want to let them down. So would you say your will to win, your aptitude, your driving ability, something was overriding what traditional sports scientists would say was the wrong approach. But then you're living proof, because you're going, well, I did it and I won. So you're wrong. Almost the same with Michael Johnson. So a 400-meter, 200-meter Olympic champion, that they said his running biomechanics, he's too upright when he runs. You know, you're shortening your stride. And Michael Johnson was like, put your hand up if you got a gold medal. Yeah, and then sports scientists were like, yeah, you're right. Usain Bolt, they say you're too tall to be a sprinter. When you come out of the blocks, you're too tall, so you're rocking from side to side. It's not like linear. There's wasted kinetic energy. Again, Usain Bolt can say, put your hand up if you're the fastest man in the world. And it's the same with you, that sports psychologists in a sport where they say sports psychology is everything. You need to focus on the process. You go, I beg to differ. And who won Formula One? Do you know what I mean?
So, no, but I'm sure you're right, and the sports psychologists are right, which is why I said that it was one of my weaknesses. But none of my opponents are perfect either. So okay. They were stronger in that area, but I then beat them in all the other areas, and especially in preparation, dedication, attention to details, progressing with marginal gains, taking in every tiniest possible improvement along the way in becoming the best possible in the areas where I have control over. So it's all these areas where I then made the difference. And then if you sum up the total, I in that year was slightly above.
I love
and
that.
And so that's the way I would put it. And then if I can come back to your fear of failure, it's something that I spoke to with Matthew Syed as well, who, by the way, you need to get on a podcast with.
You'd
connect really well. Maybe we should even do one, the three of us, because we're like all
that'd
on the
be
same.
Amazing,
we're all on the same kind of route, I think. And we talked about fear of failure. And the best way to combat fear of failure is the ninja approach, that you really work on the worst case scenario in your head and you make that okay. So the worst case scenario in Ninja's case was dying, and he really processed that in his head, worked on it, and he made that okay and accepted it. And then, I mean, then everything else is just on the upside.
Yeah.
So then your fear of failure is massively reduced. So even if you're now out there going to buy a house, if you work on the fact that, okay, if you don't get that house now for the maximum offer you're willing to put, if you keep on repeating that to yourself, and you make that scenario okay, ideal case, you even already have another house which you have an eye on, which you say, okay, if this doesn't work out, I'll be very happy to get that one. Then that is such a strength for you in the negotiation and reducing your fear of failure. It's working on that worst case scenario.
Yeah.
So that's the like one of the strongest learnings. And I got this from Matthew Syed, actually.
That's amazing.
But I was rubbish in that, so that's the problem.
Yeah, because they talk
but
about,
I've learned that now.
They call that like negative visualization, which for me was, I was like, why would I think about the worst case scenario? That's a bad...
But you make it good.
Yeah, exactly. That you know that the worst case, you're still going to be okay.
But you did that. You spoke about that yourself, though. You did that naturally. You said you don't mind if it doesn't go right, and that's why you were then in the moment.
I learned to do that, but certainly during the Great British Swim, I realized that, and you'll know this, that, you know, with the sports media and the media, it's very polar, in that if I had swum 1,600 miles and I managed to make it to Norfolk, but I didn't swim all the way around Great Britain, there was this element that it would have been a failure. You know, it would have been, I knew that I was leaving the swim a sort of hero or a villain, not a villain as such, but it was like, you know, there was this idea that it's go big or go home. And I think it's exactly the same that, and this is what I find amazing looking at your career, that once you did it, once you achieved, and we were talking earlier about, you know, this idea of your ikigai, you know, in Japanese culture, they talk about your ikigai is your sense of purpose, your reason for getting up in the morning, you know. And for you, it was all you needed. You just wanted to be the best, you know, Formula One champion. That's all you wanted. And once you won it, it was amazing how you said, that's enough, you know, and you were able, and that is unique. That is so unique. When you look back through history at all athletes, you look at those who were able to legitimately within themselves just say, I've done it, and be content. So I almost look at them as great humans, whereas sometimes a lot of athletes are amazing athletes, but they're slightly, dare I say it, flawed because they are trying to do it because of something that happened in their childhood, fear of failure, something to prove, but that drives them so much. Whereas speaking to you, it's amazing how it was just, yeah, I've done it. I'm not defined by it. Worst case scenario, if I didn't win it, that's okay as well.
No, that was not okay.
No, it wasn't.
That was not okay at all.
So what?
And I would still be going now.
Really?
Of course.
Wow. So you had to do it.
Well, of course.
Right. But then once you did, did you feel cathartic? Did you feel you've done it? Did you feel?
Totally.
Aristotle talks about, you know, I believe I'm.
It's a relief. Huge relief.
Right. But yeah. Even Aristotle, Ikigai, like I said, that is something that you're good at, you like doing, you can be paid for, and what the world needs. You know, in sports entertainment, Formula One going out to millions, that is what the world needs. It's something that you did. So did you feel, or Aristotle talks about, you know, entelechy, I believe I pronounced it right, but that Aristotle talks about birds need to fly, grass needs to grow, everything has this sense of purpose. So once you did that in 2016, did you feel, I'm good, you know, I'm cathartic, I'm at peace with the world, I don't have to?
Yeah, totally. And it's such a strong feeling. And that's why I'm so lucky, because I'm sitting here now and ending with the goal having been achieved, and then and stepping out on the, for me, highest possible point ever in my life in racing. I don't think I could have gone higher than that in the way everything turned out and everything worked out, and the way the last couple of laps, everything, and the opponent, everything perfect. And so now it's just so lucky to be able to sit here, and it's still carrying me, and it will, I think, forever. To end in on a high like that, it's just beautiful.
That's unique. When you look at, you know, Boris Becker, arguably, you know, he did that in tennis. When you look at Michael Johnson, you know, 400, 200 meter Olympic champion, and he, you know, bowed out at the top. And I find it really interesting with mixed martial arts, you know, that there are George St. Pierre, very recently retired, widely considered by many to be, you know, the greatest of all time.
And did he ever lose?
He lost, but it was the way that he came back. You know, when he lost to Matt Serra, he came back and, like, you know, it was a textbook. It was just like poetry watching him.
Really?
So he learned and came back. And then George St. Pierre said, you know, now he's retired, and he says, I've got no tears, no regrets. I did everything I wanted. So you go into a very small, in my opinion, a very small group of people who was the best, the very best in the world at their chosen sport, and equally walked away very content. And I think, and I say this sort of from experience, that, you know, after the Great British Swim, it was amazing. A lot of people were saying, oh, that's, you know, comparing it. And I like the story with Captain Webb. So 1875, you know, for those who don't know, 1875, they said the English Channel can't be swum. They said it's the tides are too strong, water's too cold, it cannot be done. But Captain Webb, on a diet of brandy and beef broth, in a woolen wetsuit and goose
in
fat.
In a woolen wetsuit.
Woolen
wetsuit. Come on. Like,
this is it.
That's not funny.
Swum breaststroke all the way across because, I quote, front crawl was ungentlemanly-like. So breaststroke all the way across. 23 hours it took him. And the record now is something like 6 hours. You know, but it was just the fact that Captain Webb, and when he did that, everyone was like, wow, you know, he can, the impossible is possible. So with the Great British Swim, a lot of people, the sailing community said, you can't swim around Great Britain. Corrie of Vecan, giant whirlpool in Scotland, it's, the tides are too strong, you know, Cape Wrath, Arctic storms coming from Iceland, you can't do it. So when I did it, there was comparisons to Captain Webb, but, and I've never sort of fully spoken about this on any podcast, and it's only now that I can,
exclusive on Beyond Victory, here we go. No, this is big.
It is, because no, genuine, I wanted to actually get your opinion on this. So this is kind of void of the podcast, it's almost looking for, you know, I suppose, your take on it so I can learn. But a lot of people are like, oh, Captain Webb, and he was celebrated. Captain Webb was on, he had his picture on a box of matches. You know, he wrote a book, The Art of Swimming. He was a celebrity at the time and widely celebrated. But what few people understand is after that, he had this desire to keep going for whatever reason. When you look back through history, they said that he was a devout husband, and he needed, maybe there was that sense that he needed to earn some more money as well for his wife and keep that lifestyle that he'd created for his family. So he said, I'm going to go and swim Niagara Falls. And they said, no, like that's swimming suicide. And people said to him, how much money did you earn from the English Channel? And he said, yeah, this much. And they said, do you want my advice? Keep that money and live as modestly as you can, you know, and be happy, be content. Captain Webb didn't listen. Swam Niagara Falls. And what people don't, and this doesn't...
What do you mean with swam Niagara Falls?
He tried to swim through Niagara Falls. With the water crashing down, he tried to swim Niagara Falls. Within all the whirlpools and the water, he tried to swim across. You know, and people were like, it's impossible. You know, the same way with the English Channel. When they found his body, he died. But when they found his body, everyone thought he died from drowning. No, like his body had basically been crushed. Wow. His limbs contorted. And the reason I say this is because, I mean, for all of the Great British Swim, and people see, you know, the lights and me coming onto Margate and hugging my family, but I'm very aware that the comparisons to Captain Webb, it's also like, that when you've got a good thing and to kind of say, okay, that was, I pushed it as far. And I think it's exactly the same with you, that the outcome with Formula One is, especially, you know, with your wife and kids, it's like you have to, you know, bear that in mind. I know it's a hobby and it's a passion that burns inside, but how did you walk away? Was it ever a question in your head, or did you just go, I'm done? Or did you have that conflict in your head where you're like, another season? Like, did you want any more? Even looking at Alex Honnold recently, who free soloed El Capitan, and he's,
I want to have him on the podcast as well. Next.
I mean, he's amazing. But but people are saying, you have to be done, right? You have to be. You know, that's like, there's nothing left to do. And it'll be really interesting to see what Alex does next. So with yourself, did you feel that? Did you want to do another season? Did you want to race again? How did you walk away? Or why did you? What was it?
Well, I still love the sport, and you get addicted to success as well. Yeah? So, of course, I wanted to do much more and win another championship and another 10 championships or whatever. But I'm quite a rational thinker, so I just rationally really pushed myself as well and listened to my instinct. My instinct was telling me now is the perfect time to go away, because it would put you in, it would be such a great thing for the rest of your life if you now stepped away in this moment after having achieved your actual goal that you had until then. And of course, the danger as well played a little bit of a role, definitely, because I was always one of those that was aware of the dangers, and one of my fellow drivers passed away just 2 years before that, Jules Bianchi in 2014, in a big crash. So it was very, very on our mind. It was still on our minds, you know, that it's still absolutely extremely risky, our sport. And there's some tracks and some corners which are just pretty crazy still. And you just know if something goes wrong there, then it's really not going to look good. So that played a small role as well. And even now, looking back and looking at them driving, I'm happy.
I love what you said there, rationally. So it was a rational decision. Almost goes back to that sports science. Totally. That you removed all emotion, any innate desire, and you just said rationally, how can I get that same? Because, I mean, now your diary is incredible. Like, you're so busy. So I love what you said. You're now just, I suppose you're realizing your ikigai, your sense of purpose, your intellectual, whatever you want to call it, just in a different arena. You know, so you're manifesting success in a different, and I think that's probably key. Whereas I think when you see a lot of champions, they do just what they know best. You know, they want to get that feeling, whether it's, you know, winning the 100-meter gold or you know, looking at the UFC, you get those kind of aging champions who just keep going in and they just keep fighting because that's all they know.
Let's talk about that then a little bit. So for me now, I'm still looking for new challenges. That's why I'm still keeping busy, because I'm always going to be a challenger, and now I'm looking for meaningful challenges, which I'm finding in this podcast, for example, where I hope that we can bring across some cool learnings to all of you who are listening. This for me is a really meaningful challenge, because we have experienced some incredible stuff in our space. And I'm sure that also now, in all that we've said, hopefully some of you listening will already have been able to pick out 2-3 things which might add value to your lives. This is what I hope and I wish. But now let's take the moment and flip it a little bit your direction.
No, I'm sorry. I came with questions.
No, but I'm happy. We can, and I wanted to, I think it's the perfect moment also to explore a little bit this drive, which you've got in bucket loads as well. I had Toto Wolff on recently.
Oh, wow.
Toto Wolff is now one of the most successful team bosses of all time in sport globally, not even just in Formula One. And he was my team boss on the way to the championship. So he's the Mercedes team boss. And he said, in every most successful person, the drive has to have come from some trauma or humiliation in youth. This is his concept.
Yeah.
Because what else would explain that these successful people are just completely mad at pushing more and more and more, and into like such severe extremities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we talk about a little bit where your drivers come from. You were a water polo player, yeah, professionally.
Yeah.
But then, and then you went, and now you have become, you were talking about the alien speaking about me being the driver.
Yeah.
The alien would speak about you being, how would you say it? The most, I mean, the person who's achieved the greatest physical extreme challenge.
Yeah.
So something like that.
Yeah, like the longest sea swim. Yeah, that I think if aliens came to this world, they'd point at me and say, he swam for 157 days and 2,000 miles and never stepped foot on land. And then aliens will go, that's weird.
Yeah, but even more, it's even more than just swimming. You've put yourself possibly into one of the most extreme physical challenges and overcome them that a human has ever done, I would suggest.
Oh, well, that means a lot. Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah.
The alien would agree anyways,
yeah,
no?
Yeah, I think you're right.
He wouldn't be too picky.
Yeah, you're right. In the, it definitely became less about swimming. You know, yeah. It wasn't about, you know, are you bilaterally breathing? What's your leg kick? It, you know, it was just...
Yeah, it's the size of the challenge.
Yeah, are you going to keep getting in the water day in, day out? So,
perfect.
You know,
where does the drive come from?
It was, I love,
why
I love that.
Why put yourself into such a unbelievably, incredibly huge,
I've been challenge. Asking myself exactly the same question, because I absolutely agree with that quote and I love that. For some reason, I haven't. And when I was even speaking on Joe Rogan, I think Joe expected there to be some deeper, you know, sort of darker thing that happened in my childhood, and I was like, my granddad was in the military, the other one was a marathon runner, my dad's a tennis coach, my mum was a sprinter, so sport was all we did. And I think my love of sport and athletic adventures just comes from this idea of set yourself a task and then just as an experiment unpick the principles, you know, of what made it happen. So it's just, I use myself as a human guinea pig, and it's weird that that desire, it's almost scientific. It's almost, you know, what will happen to the human body if you swim around Great Britain? We don't know, no one's ever done it. And I'm like, okay, cool, I'm gonna try it. And I think looking at future events, I'm just saying, like you, there has to be a reason. I don't want to just do it. Because now, if people said that, some people were saying, oh, you know, swim around Australia and sharks aside and everything else, I'm like, but it won't prove anything because it would just be a bit longer. You know, I'm looking for something that has a deeper science. If it expands our understanding of the human body or psychology, then that's what drives me. And I think when I am, you know, sort of long gone and training at the gym in the sky and I'm looking down, I'll be like, the world was a little bit of a better place because of me. People understand mental resilience a little bit more because I was there. That for me, I suppose, is this driving force of just of legacy. And also the sports scientist in me loves looking at athletes and thinking, like, I'm a bad driver, 3 driving tests, I was awful. And with me, I'm like, that's something that I'm not going to do. So I look at somebody like you and say, you expand our understanding of that area for the as humans. Whereas with me, one thing I'm really good at is swimming, floating and eating. And I'm like, so I'll push our understanding in this, you know, particular arena. So my driving force, it's strange. And I know it's strange because it doesn't, I had a great childhood and, you know, 2 brothers, so I always had training partners, we were football, tennis. So it's weird that for me, I do think I'm just driven by just trying to understand. Oh no, I suppose there's a slight fear as well of, I know that in time my body won't be able to swim around Great Britain. So, you know, when I'm 80, I don't want to ever look back and go, oh, I didn't use my full genetic potential. And I think that's one thing everybody even listening, and I love what you broadcast on your podcast, because everyone can take the teachings, and everybody has a genetic predisposition to be good at something. And for me, once I found that, which was swimming, I was like, right, I'm going to just see how far I can push this. But there'll be people listening now who will go, I'm quite good at rowing. And I'm like, great, Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge, rowing across the Atlantic 3,000 miles. I'm quite good at running. Cool, ultra marathons, Barclay marathons, sign up to that. So there's all these challenges. For me, it's just swimming. It's what I'm good at. It's what I know. And you almost feel this innate desire. I just love the ocean. So for me, it wasn't even a hardship swimming with, you know, minke whales and dolphins. It was kind of, you know, kind of the same way that it probably is with you with cars. Oh, you know, you just get it. You know, your aptitude test at Williams, that revealed you just got it. You had a genetic predisposition to always be good at that, you know, whereas other people don't. So I think that was just your ikigai, your intellectual, your sense of why you were on this earth. Formula One just helped you realize that. I think for me, swimming helped me realize that. And everybody else listening, if you're really, really careful and you listen to your body, and you'll find something. You know, even now, I think it's such an exciting time in human performance with Eddie Hall, you know, deadlifting half a ton. 500 kilos, a human lifted 500 kilos, half a ton. Kipchoge right now looking to break the sub 2 hour marathon. That's, I mean, it wasn't too long ago, Roger Bannister, sub 4 minute mile, that people said it's impossible for humans to run under a 4 minute mile. Cannot be done. And Roger Bannister was actually a medical student himself. So leading physicians at the time were saying, your lungs will explode, your legs will fly. You can't, humans cannot run under a 4 minute mile. Once he did, the following year, so many people, it was completely disproportionate to the amount of people trying to run under a 4 minute mile. So many people ran a sub 4 minute mile because he almost changed the game. You know, the floodgates were open and everyone went like, it's possible. And it's the same now with Kipchoge. Everyone's going, you know, oh God, he's getting so close to the 2 hour. And it just changes, you know, that human, we think differently. And I think that's the thing. I think for me, I'm just trying to do my bit in that arena, you know, human performance, my bit, which is just swimming.
In Greek mythology, yeah, we're split in two. We don't like each other. We're missing half. We're looking for self-acceptance, looking for recognition. It's a really, really intrinsic need, human need. Yeah, we're all in the same boat on that. Do you think maybe there's some of that there, that you're looking for self-acceptance because you don't accept yourself the way you are? You need to show yourself that I'm the best at this or that, or you will need to prove everybody else that you can do it. All the media that was ready to pounce on you when you fail, or the millions of people watching.
Yeah.
Is that maybe one of the reasons for a big driving force, the need for recognition or starting with self-acceptance?
That's really interesting. I mean, yeah, I'm going to have to take some notes on that so I can research that, because that might be. However, I always remember going across the Moray Firth. So I was swum like 1,100 miles. I'm on the home straight. I've just got the east coast of Great Britain to swim, so I'm kind of on the home straight. And again, actually, you know, to just purely because you know, this is something now I'm starting to sort of unpick these principles of the swim, because in the moment I didn't really understand it. And this was, again, I've not actually mentioned this on any podcast, so this was actually with my dad's blessing, if I'm honest, because I didn't mention this throughout the whole swim. But by the time I got to the Moray Firth on the east coast, I knew I could do it. I was like, this is fine, you know. And the East Coast is actually easier because of the weather conditions, and you're shielded by the sort of southeasterlies coming in. So it was an easier swim. Physically, I knew I could finish the Great British Swim. The coastline had thrown everything at me: giant whirlpools, jellyfish, everything. And again, so I've never actually spoke about this publicly, but it was on the, and it's only with my dad's blessing that I'm bringing it up now.
Thank you, Dad.
And I kind of knew something was wrong, but he had not been telling me this idea of streamlining stress, which you were saying, would it help me get back to Margate? No. So my dad didn't tell me, but he'd been diagnosed with cancer, basically. And my entire family had kept that from me. He'd known since. Yeah, well, no, thank you. But it was strange how they'd kept that from me all the way around, even the top of Scotland. He must have been going through so much. And he didn't tell me, because he was just like, it won't help him. He told me in the Moray Firth, because some people knew about it, and he just didn't want me to find out from anybody else. And going across the Moray Firth, I remember Storm Callum, which was the first storm of that summer, came in. So I'm now stuck, unable to get home, sitting on the boat. And I said I wouldn't, the rules of my swim were I won't step foot on land, and land is there, so I could just get on and walk. And I remember it was just, you know, so you really ask these questions about yourself, and I'm sitting there, and I just, my everything that I talk about, stoic sports science, going, oh yeah, cognitive clarity, no, that went out the window, you know. And I remember by that point I was like, I'm gonna finish Gibraltar. I heard that, my initial reaction, my gut reaction, was just to get on land and to go and hug my dad. I just wanted to go and see him. I just wanted to hug him. I wanted to be with my friends and family. That's all I wanted. And I remember my dad, who essentially streamlined stress, to quote, you know, to use that sort of concept, for me, and said no. And he was so logical, and he just said, if you come on land, you can't do anything, you know. You know, I've got cancer, you can't do anything about it. If you come on land, you give me a hug, and then I'll go, brilliant, now you're not going to finish the swim. And he said, so you can come home and you can give me a hug, but you've got to do it via Margate. And so for the entire East Coast then, for 12 hours a day in sensory deprivation, when you're left alone with your own thoughts, I knew that my dad was back on, and all I wanted to do was get back on land. So from that point on, I talk about this idea of stoic sports science and, you know, swimming with a smile and everything like that. I was just like, just swimming, just angry, just wanting to get home like I could. So to your point there, I really did have a conversation in my head, which was, am I doing this for the right reasons? Media aside, if I turn up at Margate, what will success look like for me? Will it be turning up and media and cameras? Where are, oh, no, everyone's cheering. And I was like, because if that's the case, go on land now, Ross. Stop, just go on land. That's not the right reason to do this. But is it to just arrive on land? And like I said before, actually, with my granddads and my mum and my dad, we've all got this sporting, you know, background. Or if I arrive in Margate and just my mum and my dad and my brothers are there and we all go for pizza and I can sit there and tell my dad about the Minke Whale, you know, around, you know, I was like, is that enough? And I was like, yeah, that's all I want. If I can go and have pizza with my dad and tell him about the swim, that's enough. And so I had to make sure that I was doing it for all the right reasons. And even now, I'm so glad that my dad was strong enough, was stoic enough, because I wasn't. I remember when we were sitting in it was by Dunbar, which was the second storm in Scotland, and I was just sitting there, and I had like cabin fever, and I was just like, I just want to see my dad. And I remember I turned to Matt, the captain, as well, and I was like, I'll just go swim. I'll swim. I feel helpless right now. And in my head, I was just like, if I swim, I'm helping my dad because I'm getting back to Margate. And Matt was like, you're not swimming in a storm. And I was like, no, it'll be fine. And he was like, no. So I wasn't thinking rationally at all. But it was only my dad and certainly the captain, Matt. And my dad had spoke to Matt as well and said, get him back to Margate safely. But I know what he's like. He's so stubborn. He'll go and swim in a storm if it means, you know. So for the entire East Coast, and this is something that you know, I'm going to sort of try to make sense of, but it was this idea that you have to do it for the right reasons. And I think, you know, for me, it was just, you know, getting back. And now, you know, me and dad, we sit there and we talk, you know, sports science, and he's helping with the book, and, you know, and he's, like I said, it's only now with his permission that I'm allowed to say that. So it's in a roundabout way, and as you can probably tell, actually, it's still all in my head, all very muddled up. But it was just, I needed to make sure in that moment I was doing it for the right reasons. And I think a lot of people don't do it for the right reasons, to answer your question. So when it is from a deeper, darker meaning, I think a lot of people speak about post-career trauma and, you know, and sort of similar to a lot of soldiers that I talk to, whereas there's that coping with that sheer low after such a high. Whereas for me, I never had that, because when I arrived back, all I wanted was a pizza with my dad. You know, I was like, that's it. So then for me, everyone's like, oh, how have you coped? Did you get that real dip in? And I was like, no, you know, because success, to your point, I think it looks very different for me. Success now is just, you know, like my dad, he's doing amazing. So, you know, he's having immunotherapy and he's back on the tennis. He's a tennis coach. So he's back coaching, and they've shrunk the tumors. And it's amazing.
That's really nice to hear.
And that for me, that's success, you know. So now, and I just love that every single crazy idea that I always ever have, you know, my dad just rolls his eyes and then just sort of goes, right, let's work out the logistics, you know, and he's plotting, you know, how you swim around. So success now looks very different for me because of that. And that was the hardest thing about the swim. I've never told anyone that, but when people talk about jellyfish and minke whales, that was the hardest thing of the swim, the entire East Coast, to swim with that in your head. It's only now that I'm learning to, and actually at the time I said, you know, to everyone, because we broadcasted it so much on Red Bull TV, and I wanted to be as honest and open as possible. And I actually said to everybody, I hope you don't mind, I've had some bad news. So if you see that I'm a bit not quite myself, I've had some bad news, but can you respect that? I it's not my news to tell you. And then again, my dad, just being the absolute Trojan that he is, just said, oh no, you can talk about it. You know, so he's almost practicing stoic sports science more than me, you know. It's weird that even at the age of, you know, 33, I'm still learning from him, you know. And it's just, yeah, so that was a bit That was a long, long answer, but yeah.
Can we jump into the hardest moment during the swim? Because I think that's always very, very fascinating.
Yes.
And how you fought through that and overcame it. What's the, like, pick one out. What would be the absolute toughest moment? I'm sure that one was possibly the toughest one.
Yeah.
So take a second toughest one then, please.
Yeah, so and after one that... That's, right, because after that, everything else seemed a bit trivial.
But
so,
maybe before that, then.
So before that,
up on the north of Scotland.
Yeah, the worst. So before that, and I'd take this all day, every day after the East Coast. But it was definitely Corrievechan. So you know, giant whirlpool in Scotland, and Matt, the captain, turned to me and he said, "Ross, giant whirlpool now. People have lost their lives. You know, people have lost ships. It's no joke. You have to swim and swim hard." And we hit it at a spring time.
And it pulls
time.
You downwards? Or?
Yeah. And when you were sitting up on the boat, you could see, you know, giant, you could see the whirlpool. You were like, oh, you know, I honestly thought, I was like, that sounds something like Greek mythology. I was like, no, it's legit a giant whirlpool in Scotland. I was like, wow. And we spoke to some of the local fishermen as well. Local knowledge was amazing all the way around. And some of the local fishermen there were, it got weird. They were talking about, watch out for the hag goddess. Ooh. And, you know, all this thing in folklore. I was like, who's the hag goddess? And they were like, in the Kelpie, which is this, in Scottish folklore, like shapeshifters, like mermen and mermaid. I was like, what are you going on about? And so they told me this. And I remember when I arrived at the Corrievechan, the sort of the wind, the way it funnels down into the Inner Hebrides, it just howls down there. So it's haunting. So I'm not superstitious, but at that moment I was like, oh, like the hag goddess is here. So anyway, I'm turning. I said to Matt, I was like, okay, I'll swim hard for 6 hours. So I'm swimming like this. I've got 6 hours in my head. If I can swim for 6 hours, I'll get clear of the Corrievechan. So I'm swimming. I'm looking at my watch like that as I'm swimming. And I remember I got 3 hours in, and I got stung by another jellyfish, the giant jellyfish of Scotland, like 5 meters long. But I've been stung so many times before. You know, it hurts. It's like a bad nettle sting. But it's not bad.
It's on the face, yeah?
Yeah. It's not bad. It hurts.
Do you have Vaseline on the face or anything? Or?
No. I mean, the tentacles, they're so fine. They were getting through that anyway. Oh. And after 6 hours, you have to keep reapplying it if you did. So I'm swimming as hard as I can, 3 hours, and then I get hit by this one jellyfish, and it felt different.
Did you
see
it coming?
No, that's the other thing as well. Like sometimes, it's certainly in the dark, you can't see the hand in front of your face, you know, because there's no light from the land in Scotland. It's so remote. So I stung to the face. And I remember just thinking, ooh, I said, that one feels different. If this jellyfish, it felt like somebody.
That one was the most unfriendly.
Oh, yeah, real, like, it didn't like me.
That one was mean.
It really mean. It was a hench one. But it felt like somebody had a hot poker, and they were like, it was like it was searing into my skin, this hot poker. I was like, oh. And I swim for another 2 hours or something. And I remember I was just like, my face was now numb. Like I'm almost dribbling as well because it's almost paralyzed. That's part of my face. I'm swimming. And I look up at Matt from the boat and I go, Matt, I'm so sorry. I said, I need to stop. I said, I've been stung by a jellyfish. I said, but it won't go away. It's searing into my skin. And he looked down at me from the boat and he just went, yes, I know, because it's still wrapped around your face. And the tentacle had threaded into my goggles, and I'd been wearing the tentacle and jellyfish for 2 hours swimming. So I took off, I won't repeat what I said, I threw away the jellyfish and the tentacle, and then I tried to put my goggles back on. But
oh, come on, just repeat, we can do some beeps.
I was angry. I was.
Were you angry at the jellyfish as well?
Yeah, I was angry at life. I was angry at the sea. I was angry at the hag goddess. I was angry, and I threw away the jellyfish. And then I tried to put my goggles back on because Matt's now shouting at me, going, Ross, he goes, swim, Corrievechan. So I'm now being pulled.
Another whirlpool.
Same one, but it's pulling me back in. It's a spring tide, so it's a really strong tide. It's pulling me back into the Corrievechan. And I go to put my goggles back on, but I've been stung so much. And I'll show you a picture later. And you go, my face has changed shape. My eye sockets are so puffy that my goggles won't go back on my face and they won't seal. So I'm being pulled into the Corrievechan and Matt's going, swim, like that. And I'm like, oh. So I put them on my face and I just go and panic and just punch the goggles into my face so they seal. And then I swim again for another 2 hours. I get clear of the Corrievechan. We finally make it. I'm now stung. I've got toxins in my body. My heart is like beating so fast. My eyes, my face has changed shape. And I climb onto the boat at the end of that tide after 6 hours. It's horrendous. The worst swim I've ever done. And I get on the boat and I never forget that Matt was just like, well done, mate. Yeah, okay, tide changes in 6 hours. See you again in a bit. You know, and it was just how unforgiving in that moment. You realize you've done everything, but it's still not enough. I still had 900 miles still to swim. So that for me at that moment, I was like, it's the ocean just doesn't care. It's unforgiving. Exactly the same with Formula One. It's so, it doesn't care about how many followers you've got, how much media. It doesn't care if you've got a family or not. It's unforgiving. And I think it's drawing that same parallel. It's when you know that and you don't, you know, there's that idea of sometimes people feeling, you know, sorry for themselves. And so I was just like, there was no time to feel sorry for myself. I could have, some people even said, oh, it's amazing, Ross, that you've not cried, or, you know, you've not been. I'm like, no, I want to. I was like, please don't think it's for any noble, brave reason. It's just the fact that if I wanted to get on the boat after that and you know, have a little bit of a cry and feel sorry for myself, I could have done. But I'll be back in 6 hours, and that's going to eat into my sleeping time, how much food I can take on board, if I need to sort of treat sea ulcers. That was one thing that was never really captured on camera, this idea that after every swim, you know, my neck was like chafing so bad. You can kind of still see it there, you know, that I'd have to finish a swim and I'd just have to sit there like this, upright in my bed like that, waiting for the wounds to dry, because they were like weeping wounds. So I'd just sit there like that until it basically dried enough that I could put my head on the pillow. If I didn't do that, the amount of times that Matt would sometimes wake me up at 2 o'clock in the morning, cabin door opens, wind rushing down, and Matt would say, Ross, need you on deck, tides change. I'd wake up like that, and the bed sheets would have fused to the open wounds. So I'd have to rip it off before I could actually even get in and swim. So there was so much that wasn't caught on camera, that when people ask about the darker moments or the hardest, it was always being so alone and you're the only person you can rely on. Probably very similar to what you do. It's like, you can't outsource help. Yeah, you know, you've got your team and everything, but it's, you're going around a corner at silly miles per hour. You only have yourself to rely on. I think that's one thing that would be one of the nicest takeaways from this for listeners, I think, is know that if you've prepared, and like you said, you know, you've done all of the research, you can rely on yourself, but know you're, you know, that's what you have to do in so many. It's like life, yes, absolutely, is a huge team sport, but sometimes only you, it's a real solo endeavor. I think that was the thing, just finding that it was so honest as well, the swim, in that the miles didn't lie, the metrics didn't lie. You had to swim all the way around Margate. There's no tips and tricks and shortcuts. It's cold. You're going to have to swim until your tongue falls off. Chafing wounds will get so deep that they start going into like through the skin and the actual, like going down to the tendons. You know, your, even the ligaments in your shoulders will be contorted from swimming in 50 knot Arctic winds. If a jellyfish don't care, they will sting you in the face all day. If you're prepared to do that for 12 hours a day for 157 days, you might be able to swim around Great Britain. But if not, you don't stand a chance. I think it's exactly the same that people say, what do you have to be Formula One champion? If you actually wrote out what you have to do, the hours, the sacrifice, everything, people go, oh, that makes no sense. Even, and I love Steve Jobs, when people said, you know, oh, Steve, you know, Apple, can you, you know, tell us how you've just created this tech empire? And he just paused and he said, yeah, if you knew what it would take, you probably wouldn't do it, because it makes no sense. And would you say the same, that at the start of your career, if somebody listed what you'd have to sacrifice and do, would you have gone, oh, or were you there like so involved that you just thought, I'm in it now, you know, it makes, would you say it made no sense the amount of preparation you did? It defies logic how hard you had to train and the research that you had to do.
Well, afterwards, I wouldn't say that, no, because the winning is just so damn awesome. And right. It gives my life so much, but it's always afterwards easy to say.
Right.
But of course, it was extreme. But it has to be said that, like, Formula One preparation, it's not about, like, preparing and training all day long every day. preparation for me is the recovery is like just as important for body. And in Formula One, it was almost more important even for mind, because a Formula One weekend is 200% intensity mentally. It's the most extreme form of mental intensity. I've one of the most extreme I've ever experienced. And that every 2 weeks, 4 days in a row. And so the mental recovery was just as important. Yeah. And again, I did that like in a very, very calculated way, trying to perfect that and learning how best to do that.
And because that's interesting, where people don't understand that fatigue, you have two forms of fatigue. There's peripheral fatigue, which is basically, you know, lactic acid in the muscles, you know, cardiorespiratory endurance. So that's peripheral fatigue, that if you go and run 800 meters,
yeah, totally,
you will experience peripheral fatigue. For those listening, oh, that's peripheral fatigue. But what you're talking about is that central fatigue, your central nervous system, neurotransmitters, the chemical signals in the brain, that it was just fried, that after like so intense, like mentally. So how do you detox from that? What strategies did you have in place? Because that's, I think, something that everybody listening can learn from, that when they, if they've got a deadline at work or training, you know, how do you combat central fatigue, like that mental kind of, what strategy? Meditation?
So that's simplicity, yeah? So there's a family and no social media, no news, no games, no rubbish. And then instead of that, it's maybe reading a philosophy book, lying on the veranda.
Yeah. Yeah,
that is the ultimate for it. Or nowadays, listening to a podcast.
Yeah.
I just listened to Oprah Winfrey, actually, which is becoming one of my role models now in podcasting. And she has Super Soul, it's called.
Yeah.
And it's really, really inspirational and very, very deep, very philosophical, with some great guests. And so just listening to something like that, that's like super powerful recovery. And you're making progress as a human being at the same time, which brings happiness. And I swam a lot as well for my F1 training. It was one of my main sports because I also did triathlon. And if I can, if in the process I had some experiences that might have been similar to what you had there, or maybe I'll just add how it possibly benefited me from my F1 driving as well. So I chose swimming specifically because in an F1 car, you really can't breathe very well. Yeah, you have the seatbelts super tight, extremely tight. And because I was always a little bit of the scared person, I always pulled them much tighter. Some drivers just take it totally chilled out and leave them really flapping about. But I could never do that because I would be scared. So I had to pull them really, really tight, which again was a bit of a negative for me because it made my breathing even more difficult. And then every time you're in braking or cornering, you can't breathe. Because the G-forces are so extreme, you have to tense your whole body to hold yourself in position to be able to control the car. So breathing-wise, it's a really, really, really tough sport and completely inconsistent and unnatural to the way of your everyday life or even to your normal training. And so I specifically chose swimming because I thought, okay, maybe it will help my body a little bit to get used to this difficult breathing situations where you have to hold your breath, then breathe again quickly, hold your breath, breathe again quickly. And I think it really worked. It really worked. It helped me in exactly that way. And so that's why I really loved to swim a lot at the time. And it just made me then that little bit fitter in those toughest races where it was hot. And Singapore race, yeah, we lose like 4 kilos of body weight in 2 hours. Doctors say it's extreme. I know you went through much more torture than that. But for me, it's like the most torture I've ever experienced in a sports way. And there to have learned to breathe in difficult circumstances, it really helped me cope with that. And so that's one of those learnings. But apart from that, nothing compared to what you've experienced, of course, because it was always just an hour session or something, not more than that. And never in the middle of choreo beckons with a giant jellyfish on the face, ripping through my skin and my goggles, and with the eyes so puffed up that I had to punch the goggles back into my face so that they would hold. But so I never went to those places.
You're so right that I think it's so similar in that what you described there, I think just breathing strategies and techniques, they're not really looked at so much. But I think I always find with sports science, we kind of lack a lot of research in that area because we can't monetize it. So people want to say, okay, here's the latest electrolyte drink, carbohydrate drink, protein drink, because, you know, there's a commercial agenda, you know, whereas with breathing, everybody breathes, it's free. So there's not as many studies on it because there's no, you know, there's nothing commercially to be had from there being a good outcome. So I think that's absolutely right what you're saying there, that when you start looking at just, you know, oxygen deprivation on any, whether it's an hour, whether it's Kariovekin with a giant jellyfish, it doesn't matter. But you start starving the brain of oxygen, and you are, you know, if you've ever done like altitude tests, you know, when you start looking at what happens to the people climbing Everest, you know, it's fascinating that people think it's purely physical. And it's only just now, going back to what we were talking about with the ancient Greeks, they understood this mind-body connection. And it's this idea that, yeah, with completely starved of oxygen, not even completely, slightly starved of oxygen, if you're able to actually continue to breathe, Wim Hof, actually, he would be amazing.
Legend.
Oh, you yeah.
You need to, everybody listening, you need to watch that, the Yes Theory on YouTube.
He's amazing.
Wim Hof video.
But he talks so cool. about, so those breathing techniques that he talks about to actually alter your biochemistry, he says that we're all alchemists, have our own biochemistry. You know, so it's exactly that, that too often we think of ourselves in terms of, you know, like mechanical machines. It's like, no, we are these complex biochemical organisms. And if you're able to continually and efficiently oxygenate your body, even look at the pH that Wim Hof talks about so much, that, you know, when you start to make sure your body is slightly more alkaline, it's naturally more alkaline rather than becoming acidic, which you can do through his breathing techniques that he taught me. Exactly the same.
He taught you, not in person though.
Yeah, no, so I lived with him in Stroh, in his house in Stroh.
Oh,
Nick, you're going to have to come out.
Oh,
it's
come
amazing.
On.
Well, this is weird. So this is incredible.
We're continuing the podcast. Let's go. We're adding another hour now. Come on.
Good question. But so they're very quickly. So yeah, with Wim, he invited me out to Stroh. So this was before the Great British Swim, and he was, you know, the cold was going to be a real issue. And one of the things that he taught me was not only this idea that we're atrophying these ancient age-old mechanisms. So, you know, when we get in the cold, our capillaries vasoconstrict and vasodilate to try and thermoregulate our bodies. You know, so all of us in this room now, if I said, everybody, right, let's go and jump in an ice cold lake, everyone will be like, no, why would you do that? But it's this idea that our bodies like homeostasis. Right now, if it's cold in here, we just turn the heating on. But our bodies, as a result, we're atrophying these ancient mechanisms to try and, you know, control our temperature. And that's what Wim Hof preaches. So when I was living with Wim, we were there learning not only that physiological adaptation, that as soon as you get into the ice water, I mean, he's been doing it years. He's like, so when he gets in, he's just, his capillaries just almost like that. They pull all the blood away from his extremities, his hands, and they protect his vital organs. So his that is turned on in him, is switched on, like our ancestors. You know, they wouldn't have anything. We didn't say now, oh, do you do a cold shower? Do you do an ice bath? You know, our ancestors, it wouldn't have been an ice bath, it would have just been a bath. You know, because they didn't have hot water. So they're used to that. So there's that element, this physiological adaptation to the cold, which Wim taught me, that certainly helped around Dunnett's Head, top of Scotland, when I was swimming in Arctic storms. But also this idea that breathing will alter your biochemistry. So when you get into the cold, you want that gasp reflex where you start to hyperventilate. And that's almost like your subconscious, almost like, your subconscious is almost like a child, and it's going, get out, it's misbehaving. This child is going, get out of the water. But your conscious has to almost override that and say, look, I know you're scared. I know you want to get out, but this is okay. Everything you're experiencing now, you know, with your hands going like numb, that's just like pulling away, you know, blood from your extremities. It's okay. So through breathing and focusing on your breathing to remain present and in that moment, you're able to essentially override your subconscious in a way. Wim does an amazing job, and where he's taking this research is incredible. Nico, we have to go out to Stroh. It's amazing. But it's just a weekend, and it's like it awakens, like I said, these ancient age-old mechanisms. I remember when me and him were sitting in there in the ice bath, and I sat in there. I managed to get up to like 40 minutes. And
how much?
40 minutes in the ice
40?
Bath. Yeah. I know. So we're sitting in there. He's got these huge barrels, and we're sitting there like that, and he's in the barrel next to me. And I remember I was like, Wim, and the competitive element in me, the sports scientist. I was there, and I was going, Wim, I said, I'm doing well, aren't I? And he was like, yeah. But, you know, it's all about listening to your body. I went, yeah, I'm listening. I said, but, you know, well, shall I do an hour? Shall I do 100, you know, 80 minutes? What shall I do? And Wim just kind of realizing that it wasn't about that. It's about understanding your physiology and breathing everything. I remember he looked over at me and he just goes, do you really want to know what's next? I said, yeah, I want to know what's next. 60 minutes. What is it? 70? He goes, no. He goes, the next challenge. I went, yeah, I'm listening. He goes, the next challenge to truly master the ice bath. I went, yeah. He goes, is you need to get an erection in the bow. And I was, he goes, that is when you can truly master your biochemistry. I to this day, I don't know if he was joking or not. And I didn't try it. But I was like, right, oh, okay. But, and that's the thing with Wim, you know, his sense of humor is incredible, but it did highlight, I'm so sorry, this is the last time I'm invited back here. but it was this idea that, yeah, altering your biochemistry, breathing, having control over your physiology under extreme circumstances, and breathing is one way that he does that. And I think one thing that Wim is incredible at is pioneering our understanding of that, because to date, breathing, meditation, it's almost seen as something that, oh, you know, they, you know, monks do, but it's, you know, it's like, no, it's available to all of us, just breathing technique. And that's why I love what you said just about it should be something that you can turn on, whether you're, you know, going, you know, silly miles per hour, you know, in a Formula One car, or, you know, you're sitting in an ice bucket trying to get an erection. You know, it's the same sort of, it's the same sort of thing. Sorry.
So, dear Wim, if you're listening, please welcome us over to your place then at some point soon again.
Yeah? Honest, you would love it. You would find it fascinating.
The only thing is I'm scared because, like, I was watching the Yes Theory, and they jump into the ice cold water for 10 minutes with him, yeah?
Yeah.
And they literally, like, they cannot feel anything anymore after 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm really scared. Like, where's the limit on that?
You're right.
Or you think it's all good, they're safe, or what?
I honestly believe that when you, again, human biology has remained relatively unchanged for thousands of years. So we are so much more powerful than our own minds often lead us to believe.
I know, but things will freeze off at some point. I mean, I just met Mike Horn, the explorer, who had to cut off his own finger.
You're right.
Because it went blue and it went dead. So he had to chop off his own finger.
You're absolutely right.
Because otherwise it risks infecting the rest of the body.
You're absolutely
right. So there's a limit to everything.
You're right. But I mean, some of those, when you start looking at, you know, like Ranulf Fiennes, who's amazing. He talks about like going into his shed and sawing off his fingers. Yeah, that he just looked at them and just went, yep, they're no good to anyone. He sawed them off. Or he talks about he got in the bath and he kind of looked at his fingers and was like, yeah, I don't know if they're going to sort of stay on much longer. And they fell off. And he left them on the side of the bath.
Well, there you go. So how do you know that's not happening to you in the ice bath?
It's exactly it. So that comes from sheer education, knowing that, yes, when you get in and people go, and they start that gasp reflex, and they go, I'm going hypothermic. It's like, no, can I stop? You've been in 5 seconds. That's not hypothermia. That's the gasp reflex. That's cold shock.
Yeah, so where does hypothermia come in?
Many minutes, hours, minutes down the line. So this is exactly it. And if you get out and you've got that cold management, you get out, you heat up your body, have something to eat, thermic effect to do. There's strategies that Wim on. We have to make this happen. You would love it.
Oh my goodness.
That when you do it afterwards.
Oh my goodness. <you'd> say, dear listener, do you want a YouTube vlog on that? Then
you would.
Me
love
and Ross
it.
We're visiting Wim Hof.
You would love
and me
it.
Me chickening out after 20 seconds and jumping back out and going home.
But he will. He what Wim has an amazing ability. He talks you through the whole thing. So it's exactly what you just described, saying that feeling will be so alien to you as it is to most of us, because we're used to now controlling our body temperature and things. But I honestly believe our ancestors wouldn't have thought anything about going swimming and across a frozen lake, because that's what needed to be done. You know, that's what they needed to get there. They needed to go hunt. They needed to move their family. We were nomadic during certain parts of human existence. We had to travel like that. So now, even sometimes I'll barefoot run and I'm going running, like, you know, around London, and I've got no shoes on. People looking at me going like, what is he doing? And it's just like, but no, you know, we've atrophied these, like, you know, ligaments, tendons in our feet by putting on these big shoes. So me running barefoot, you're looking at me like I'm strange, but really, you know, society has changed. I'm working like Mother Nature intended. And I think it's the same. This is 100% happening. I'm ringing Wim when I get off this. Honestly, I will make this happen. Everything that you're describing about just that alien feeling and that fear, that's exactly it. Actually, to almost quote you, you know, I know you're going to regret this.
No,
you know,
I'm already suffering now, because I know that I'll do it. I would do
the
it.
The same
but
way
I'm
that you said
now,
with your public speaking.
It's not good.
The public speaking, but now you're comfortable with it. I honestly believe, and I'd love to do this, and at the end of the year, for you to still be doing ice baths,
I hate the cold. It's the worst thing. I hate it so much.
Did you hate public speaking as well?
Yeah, but I hate the cold even more.
But do you hate public speaking now?
No.
Then do you feel that at the end of this year, you'll be like, I love the cold?
I'll always hate cold. Okay, we're doing this. So everybody stay tuned. Me and Ross are going to visit Wim Hof. Happiness. Let's go on happiness. What are you doing? How are you looking on that? And what are you doing for it?
Something that I'm working hard on. And I know that sounds weird, but I think...
On average. Are you below average? Above average?
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, I love what I do. I mean, it's a blessing. And this is the thing. For all of the hardship, I think a lot of people will talk about, you know, the swim and they'll go, oh, your tongue, your neck chafing and everything. But for all of... I almost call it healthy hardship in that I think, you know, you're there and... You can't. This isn't so bad. No one's forcing me to swim. The sunsets are pretty amazing. The sunrises are amazing. You know, swimming with dolphins. You know, the minke whale in the Bristol Channel as well. This was an experience. It was just incredible.
Do we have him on video? The minke whale?
Yeah.
He's on video?
Yeah, I'll send you the clip.
Let's throw it into the vlog here.
It's amazing that just. You know, so for those who don't know, who didn't maybe watch the Great British Swim, when I swam across the Bristol Channel, because I was swimming for 12 hours a day, the wildlife became very familiar with me and was like, oh, he's back again. He's just, you know,
You made friends.
Loads of friends. Loads of, apart from the jellyfish.
That's nice.
But this minke whale, it was swimming around me and swimming under me. It was blowing bubbles in my face. And I remember I turned to Matt and I said, like, whoa, like, what is that? And he goes, it's a minke whale. I said, it's fine.
What was his name?
I don't know. I didn't name it. I think it was a girl.
What do you mean? Poor thing.
Well, you're right, actually. We spent a lot of time together. we think it was a female. So the reason we say that is because I said, Matt, what is going on? And this minke whale was just like, wouldn't leave me alone. It was kind of like swimming under me, like I said, and everything. For 5 miles all the way to Wales, this minke whale followed me. And I said, Matt, what is going on? And he said, I think
she felt for you.
This is it. So Matt said, I think it's a female. And I think that she thinks that you're an injured
seal.
She
wanted to help.
Yeah, she did. So she guided me all the way to Wales. And then when we looked on the marine tracker, as there's the actual depth of the sea, it got a little bit shallower. That whale kind of breached one more time as if to say, you know, you're safe now, you weird sea-dwelling mammal. And then, like, let me carry on to Wales. And it was... So to go back to your original question about happiness, I think you always find some unbelievable moments. And I love what you just said there, just about when I said, what about the hardship? What about the sacrifice? And you just went... It was worth the winning, you know, so you knew that there's this ability to sacrifice now, but have this form of elation that so few people will understand. I mean, is that fair to say that you almost knew that you were sacrificing now, but what you were going to get was just going to be incredible?
Yeah, the problem was I never believed I'd get it.
Really?
So even with that, and then managing to win is another cool thing for all of you listeners who don't believe in yourself.
Really?
You don't have to believe in yourself to have huge success.
This is amazing.
And anyways, you can't. Everybody says believe in yourself. It's bullshit. You can't just flip the switch and start believing in yourself. It doesn't work like that.
But this is incredible. So, like, what you're describing is just basically, like, when you were talking about, you know, every champion has flaws. It's just how much you can learn to limit your limitations on that. Yep. And it's now the same. You're saying you don't have to believe in yourself. You can have flaws. This is incredible. Are you going to write about this?
I am writing a book soon, yes.
This is incredible.
And it won't be about Formula One. It'll be about human performance and personal development, yeah.
Which is incredible.
Because I love the whole space.
When is that coming out? I'm going to pre-order.
Are you going to order it?
Well, 100%. I'm going to pre-order now.
I'll give you a free copy.
Right, this is amazing. But this is... So you're almost like, I love this. But that's the thing. I think, like, when you look at Nassim Taleb, a famous economist, and one of the quotes of his that I always love, he said...
Black Swan.
Exactly, Black Swan Theory. Wow, yeah. And he was talking about, as humans facing limited knowledge, always resort to prescribed ideas and narratives. And it's always like we're trying to put things into pigeonholes and we're trying to understand how the world works. It's like with food, when we go, oh, calories, yes, that's how food works. And we look, I mean, you know, few people understand that the calorie was invented by a French physician who had his head in a steam engine and needed to basically measure what that energy was putting out. So he invented this idea of a calorie. It wasn't long before a guy called Wilbur, actually, he measured the thermic effect of food. So he burnt food and measured its exothermic effect, so how many calories it was giving off. Once we had that, we then introduced it to the American food system. And it wasn't long before now we all understand, you know, that calorie counting, this idea of, you know, that food has this number of calories is what we understand now. But food is far more intricate than that. You know, it gets so much more, we're extracting far more than calories from food, vitamins, minerals, phytochemicals, everything. It's really intricate. But we humans like to think we know how things work. So we're just like, yes, calories and food, we've got it. But it's exactly what you're describing now as well, where I think sports psychologists like to say, this is how the brain works. And we like to think we know how it works. And we put things into pigeonholes. again, Nassim Taleb, facing limited knowledge, we resort to prescribed ideas and narratives. And what I love about what you're doing is just, no, it's far more intricate than that. And no one can argue, because ultimately you did it. You know, you are a case study, so you can't argue.
But I have to add that my sports psychologist says I don't really fit into his concepts.
Right. So in sports, we call that like an outlier. So he's saying you're an anomaly.
A little bit, yes.
Really?
And he's seen a couple of sports within his time. So.
No, that's amazing. What, he said it doesn't make sense how you're, no, what, I'm you're just, wired I'm different?
But because it's usually that is a little bit of a weakness where it'll be, it's not the, I think it's, not the strongest form of sport of personality for having great success,
right.
Because generally the people who are most successful, and especially the ones who win many many championships and have a lot of success, more on the very very self confident side.
Yeah,
the tendency towards that. Yeah, so that's why. But anyways, but there's also weaknesses with that, because then you don't question yourself as much.
Yeah,
because you always think the other one's wrong, I'm right anyways. And you don't learn as much. So that's a big weakness of those kind of people.
Because this goes, Steve Trapmore, he was the head gold medalist rower, but also coached the Cambridge rowing team. And it always stuck with me that he said, I said, what makes a great rower? And we were looking at the British rowing team at the time. So Steve Redgrave, they said, with Steve Redgrave, he was strong. Like, he came from a rugby background. And they always talk about one of the first times that they introduced him to Olympic lifting. Apparently, you know, they were like, here's Olympic lifting. This is a clean and jerk. And you disappear under the bar, speed of movement. Apparently, he just ripped and reverse bicep curled like 160 out the floor. And they were like, that's not how you do it, but you kind of did it, you know. And they were like, he's so strong. With Matthew Pinsent, they said he has the VO2 of a horse. They were like, your lungs make no sense. And with James Cracknell, he was able to just tap into that lactic threshold, you know, where your lungs are burning, your legs are burning. And they'd say, right, you're now at your anaerobic lactic threshold, you're there. And he would just go, nope, no, I'm not. And they go, no, you are. And he go, nope, the computer's lying. So he was able to just go into this horrible, like in that real hole, and just like live in there and survive in there, and just that like lactic threshold cave. And what Steve Trapmore said to me is, he said, but what's interesting, there's no blueprint for a great rower, but the best athletes are the best at doing what they do best. I said, what do you mean by that? I said, if you're strong, you're really strong. You know, looking at the even football, the Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi debate. With Messi, he's a magician. He's unbelievable. Like with the ball at his feet, it just looks incredible. It's like poetry in motion. You look at Cristiano Ronaldo, and he's a specimen. He's an athletic phenom. He will leap higher than any other, and he's incredible. But they're the best at doing what they do best. And I think it's probably the same, that what you're saying here is, you know, yeah, there's no blueprint, but I was really good at doing what I did better than anyone else. So looking at other drivers, for instance, is there something, even looking at now or past, is there something that the past champions did better than anyone else? Is there an attribute that they just owned better than anyone else and just was able to play to their strengths whilst limiting their limitations?
There's different ways of becoming champion, as I said, but I think the greatest champions, I had Michael Schumacher as my teammate for 3 years. So I was really able to study him, and I learned, first of all, passion, unbelievable passion for what he's doing, unbelievable drive, dedication, every day, all day. I mean, the power he puts into to win, yeah, unbelievable. And the attention to detail. For example, he pioneered that it's not just about driving, but there's a huge technological opportunity to use for your advantage. So he like loaded the steering wheel up with buttons. He pioneered the way of, even on a qualifying lap, change the switches from corner to corner to optimize for each different kind of corner that's coming. Because with the electronics on the steering wheel, you can change like 100 different parameters on the car, which can transform the balance of the car like entirely. And he pushed everybody forward on that. The others, they were just driving. And he's driving at the same ability as they are, plus thinking corner to corner, how to set his car up on the steering wheel with all the 30 different switches. And in a qualifying lap, where you're maxed out all the way through, and he had this capacity left to then perfect every corner, and every corner is different, yeah? One corner you break in a straight line, all the way down to like 60, and then you turn in the last moment. Another corner, you're going in very, very high speed, totally different. And they require totally different electronic settings. If you have the capacity, most drivers don't. Even today, there's some drivers that haven't figured that out yet.
But so they didn't adopt that?
No, and this is something that I really learned then from Michael. And that I pretty much mastered as well afterwards. And it's this having the capacity left to really use that so powerfully. And it can give you up to a tenth per corner sometimes. It, depending on how extreme the corner is and how unique it is, it's huge, huge, huge. And it's a huge opportunity to again, find an area where you can beat all the others.
And that's adding more complexity to what is already an incredibly complex...
You're going 350 on the straights. Things are flying at you. And at the same time, you have to have the capacity left to think about all these new settings for the next corner, which could be in 2.5 seconds time, and flip the switches and then do the braking and get that all right.
But if you're prepared to do that, that will give you the edge, essentially.
Well, there's an opportunity for extra lap time, as in many different areas. What a gladiator. Like in his head, huh?
Yeah.
And in a natural way, he doesn't even have to think about it. And he wakes up in the morning and it's like, how can I destroy my opponent's mentally? Of which the teammate is the first guy.
Yeah, yeah. But now see, so you're, I mean, such a nice guy sitting here chatting to you. So you're
I'm actually like that, which is a bit of a problem. So right. I had to learn to become more fierce.
Right.
Which I really made as a big part of my whole mental work. I really made that a big part of it, to learn to become more fierce, just push the boundaries more,
yeah.
Become more angry sometimes in certain situations.
So you had to
learn. don't accept to hold back, but to push right into it when it starts to feel uncomfortable. And when like Michael would put me into an uncomfortable situation, I would stand up and I would say my opinion very strongly. Whereas growing up, I would then always go hide. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is something I learned also through understanding, because I understood the power of that. Of speaking and pulling down the curtain and saying how you are and what you're feeling openly. It has an incredible force. And so I really learned that. Yeah. And then, for example, we were in the engineering situation, and even when my strategy was being talked about, it was just being explained to Michael, not to me. So his strategy was explained to him, and my strategy was explained to him. and nobody spoke to me about my strategy, because he just commanded such respect and such power, yeah, in the room. He was like God. I mean, he's like God.
And did he do that prior to success? Or is it something that you learnt? Does that help with success, that people go, listen, you know, he's speaking? Or, for instance, did you start to command it even before you won?
Well, the success happened helps a lot, of course.
Yeah.
But you have to do it even. You shouldn't depend on success. You can do that even without success. And in fact, I did, because I hadn't even won a race at the time. I was a non-race winner, and he was a 7-time world champion. So I had to build that.
But
respect.
But you looked at that and said, "I need to command that same sort of like."
Totally. Yeah, yeah. Totally. Yeah. I never managed, because I mean, he really is God. But I really managed to make some big steps and also position myself more strongly internally. And then I would tell that engineer, who is one of the best that we have, I would tell him, "Please, it's very important to me that you address me in the same manner as Michael when we're sitting in these meetings together." And then he listened, and it really has impact. And he then did that. And I'm very thankful. And you know, that's how you step by step then work your way into... And then Michael gets more respect because he sees that. And it's like a step-by-step progress, which every time you do it, it's like suffering, huh? Because to open yourself up like that and say your mind is very tough. But I always pushed myself, and that's one of my biggest learnings, the importance of pushing into suffering, because that's where you progress. Don't hide away when there's situations which will cause suffering. Push right into them flat out. And I'm sure you're very good at that.
Yeah. They just find like
with the type of person that you are.
Yeah.
But that's huge for improving as a human being. It's like one of my most important learnings. And now I'm very happy to do that.
Yeah.
Even yesterday, I held a keynote speech in front of Unilever, which is one of the biggest global companies. And there was all the leadership there. I couldn't even speak in front of my school class when I was 6 years old or 10 years old, from fear and shyness and fear of them thinking I'm an idiot or whatever. And now I can even speak in front of the global leaders of a global company on my own in a keynote with nothing but a few notes on a paper. And it's just because I've done it over and over and pushed into the discomfort.
Yeah.
And that's made me progress. So I think it's a good moment to come to an end now. Let's cover what is your biggest learning that you're taking home from our chat today, and then I'm going to cover mine.
I've got to be honest, what you just said then, I loved, in that get comfortable being uncomfortable, because certainly when you were racing and when I was swimming, there's nothing comfortable, you know, about swimming around Great Britain, but ultimately things don't get easier, you get stronger. I think that's the thing. And it's exactly what you just described then. That's completely task dependent. So it doesn't necessarily matter if it's swimming, you know, motor racing. It doesn't matter. It's just, you know, getting comfortable being uncomfortable. And I love what you said there as well, just about taking ownership. I think it's exactly the same that during the swim, I had to learn about, you know, tides, weather, you know, all sorts, because ultimately, when you're empowered, and I think it's something now we're so keen to outsource expertise. Just tell me, people just want to be told what to do. You know, I want things real simple. It's like, yes, simplicity, absolutely, but equally take ownership and empower yourself. You know, I always say, even with health and fitness, there's many things that you should outsource. You know, your finances, maybe if you're not very good at building work, I'm not very good, I can't put up some shelves, I outsource that. But with health and fitness, that is something, and certainly your career, whatever it is, that is not something you should completely outsource. I think it's something you need to take ownership of. But also, I think one of the biggest things, and I love what you just said about the, I just still got images of you meditating while just like going, you know, I think that's incredible.
Didn't happen though, huh?
No, I didn't meditate in the race.
But
I find it,
Didn't work out.
I like that for me is, yeah, to have even just a second in that meditative state when the world around you is just, you know, stress and stimuli. There's that saying.
No, but I didn't manage to do it.
No, I know you didn't.
But I think, like, it's possible, yes.
Yeah, no, I know, and that's what I'm saying. I'm just kind of like, that for me is a little bit of a goal that's so, like, only you'll probably, I want to be able to just ring you up one day and go, I did it. I was meditating when going around Corrie Aveckan with a jellyfish on my face. You know, so it's this idea of, like, being able to tap into the right mindset at the right time, even if it's for a split second. I think if you do that and you're able to actually control yourself, it's incredible. That's incredibly powerful. But what about you?
Many things, but something that I'm going to take away directly is your drive to learn as well. I really love that, how you're reading a lot and progressing there. That's really powerful, and I can do more of that, even more. I'm doing it as well, as you hear and see, but there's always more, and so I'm going to take that away and dive a little bit deeper. And that's something I can recommend to you listeners as well, and everybody else who's in the room at the moment with us. There's a huge ocean of opportunity to learn in the whole mental space. There's geniuses who've been through exactly whatever we're experiencing every single day. There's been a genius who's experienced the same, and he's written it down for us in a way that it's understandable for us. So it's all there, ready to go for us to understand if we just make the effort and go look for it. Yeah. And I mean, of course, in the space of philosophy, psychology, whatever, so much opportunity to help yourself, to improve as a human being, to learn, to grow, and which we don't learn in school. Like, nobody tells us that there's that. It's like unbelievable. We don't learn it.
No, you're right.
It's there. Like, go for it. Let's push into it.
I love that. It's like that success leaves clues, you know, and I love what you said about Michael Schumacher there, that it's just kind of like, yeah, just look at what people have done before. Or Isaac Newton, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, that's, I love that.
So the best book to recommend from you now, please. Something easy, though, to start off with.
Aside from yours that I'm pre-ordering.
No, something easy where it really gives you a great insight into what's out there. I like the A Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. Have you heard of that one?
No.
That's worth a read.
Really? Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to get that one. I suppose what helped me so much on the swim was Marcus Aurelius' Meditations.
Okay, you that's know, cool. So, is it easy to read, though?
Yeah, you can kind of dip in and out of it as well. That's the nice thing, that you can just pick out bits that you need at that moment in time.
Yeah, but the problem is you need something which will sort of capture you. Huh? Mm. If it's too tough to read, it's always a challenge.
Yeah.
It needs to be something that's...
For me, it's always just something, yeah, you can apply. So with Marcus Aurelius, it's not so hard, you know, but you'll pick things out that certainly help me. And I think the greatest thing about that is you look, and it's just what you just said there. Everything that all the questions and everything that we have now, we were still facing thousands of years ago. It's not changed. Human biology, human psychology has remained relatively the same. Agricultural revolution, industrial revolution, you know, the world has changed around us, but we're still faced with this task of running our own brains. And that's what Stoic philosophy, you know, essentially teaches you. And it's something that I'm trying to now, you know, apply in the sports science realm. So yeah, certainly something like that with Marcus Aurelius's work or Seneca, it's great to read that because it just makes you realize they face the same problems that we are now.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to cover, so please, your book, The World's Fittest Book, check it out.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some great learnings in that. And you're on a world tour at the moment.
That's right.
Speaking.
Yeah.
Trying to give people insights and teachings about all the stuff you've learned.
Yeah.
So that's...
Like you said, it's nervous. It's hard. Is it like, but I'm getting there. It's good.
All right. So dear listener, thank you very much for tuning in. Please remember to subscribe if you're listening to the first time. And thanks a lot. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you, Ross, again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your podcast is called Ross Edgley, right?
That's right, yeah. Thank you so much.
If you're listening on my one, then tune into Ross's podcast as well. And that's it. Over and out. Bye-bye.
That was amazing.